Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ethan Besser-Frederick, a host of the channel, and today we'll be talking to Margaret Chowning, a professor at UC Berkeley, about her new book, Catholic Women and Mexican Politics, 1750 to 1940. Hello, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Margaret, before we begin, could you tell us a little bit about your research interests and how you came to write this book?
Sure. This is my third book. It was meant to be my second book. After I wrote the book that came out of my doctoral dissertation, I had this idea in mind to approach the topic of Mexican politics from a kind of unusual, unconventional angle. That is through a study of women and the church. In my first book, I had done the same thing with a study of liberal politics through economic and social history. So this was kind of a continuation of my work in my first book. But I didn't really know what I meant by women in the church. The only thing that the first thing that occurred to me is that women in the church would surely be nuns. So I went to the archive in Morelia, Michoacán, the cathedral archive, and asked for the boxes on female convents. And before long, I began seeing a different book emerge, which turned out to be my second book, which was called Rebellious Nuns, The Troubled History of a Mexican Convent. And that was a detour, a fairly significant detour. It was a really fun book to write. And I hope it has been a fun book for people to read, but it prevented me from returning to this book on Catholic women for quite a few years. So I guess that book was published in 2006. So I came back to this one, 2007, probably. And as you know, Ethan, from being a historian yourself, historians are pretty slow. So 2007 to 2023, probably about par for the course. I ended up not including nuns in this book since I had just written a book about nuns. And so this book uses as its kind of unit of analysis the thing that I was sort of looking out for in the archives. Voluntary Catholic associations. So the title says Catholic women, but more precisely, it's in most of the chapters, five of the eight chapters, it's Catholic women in cofradías or lay associations. The other three chapters are more about Catholic women kind of generally, Catholic women in politics, though I still try as hard as I can to link that story of Catholic women in politics back to the Catholic lay associations. So that's how this book came about. It was not an accidental book, but it was a delayed book.
Well, I think every historian, even if it doesn't turn into a book project, can appreciate that sometimes you just need to follow what you find in the archives, and finding those nuns, I think no one begrudges you that.
For sure. Yeah, that was too good a story to not give it its own book.
So let's take a look at the introduction. The introduction makes a couple of important framework arguments, and one of the important ones that mattered a lot to me was challenging the Whiggish version of Mexican history, if I can call it that, that casts the church as just a mere roadblock to progress. And I think this falls into the great set of literature on Mexican history and Latin American history that makes a more complex picture. You also set up one of the driving tensions of the book, that Mexican women have often found political and social power within a Catholic faith that explicitly denies them leadership roles. And this contradiction is one of the driving, I think, sort of feelings and moods of the book, if nothing else. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about this contradiction and what brought you to it, or how you saw it play out in the book.
Yeah, that's a good identification of a major paradox, I guess. We are all looking for interesting paradoxes to explode or explore, right? And that's my discovery that the mid-century church found itself in such a difficult position that it was more or less required to allow women to assume leadership of lay associations was an exciting and, to be honest, unexpected discovery. It's a little bit of an interesting story. So I think the listeners might be interested in my first encounter with the Ladies of the Vela Perpetua, which is a lay organization that listeners from Mexico will certainly know. Many friends of mine have told me their grandmothers were members of the Vela Perpetua, and that they used to go with their grandmothers to the churches to sweep and clean and do a little bit of praying along the way. I've always heard of it and known of it and thought of it as a totally innocuous organization, a little stodgy, a little very conservative. So when I found fairly early in my research a document that started off, "We, the ladies who sign below, are forming a new association," that basically said in the first couple of sentences, only women will be allowed to be the officers of this association. And I looked at it and I got out a figurative magnifying glass to be sure that I was reading señoras instead of señores. And it was a total surprise. And then as I kept going in that box of materials, I found other excitement in nearby towns had seen this organization formed. It was in San Miguel de Allende, and wanted one of these new organizations for themselves. So that was that tension that you referred to between a Catholic church that feels very almost misogynistic. And this discovery that in 1839, the Catholic Church was allowing women to lead, take on leadership roles in important local associations was sort of changed the whole thrust of the book. I had found my paradox in a way.
Well, I think that appears wonderfully throughout the book, and that's something I think we'll come back to as we talk about the rest of the chapters.
For sure. Mm-hmm.
The book itself is divided into three parts, and the first has to do with the periods immediately before and then during and after independence, and framing how this event does and doesn't change practice, religion, and gender. The first chapter situates this period by examining gender roles in urban cofradías in the last years of colonial rule. So could you tell our readers a little bit about these cofradías? You've already described them a little bit, but maybe expand on that, and what role gender played in them at the end of the colonial period.
Right. So cofradías or Catholic lay associations were important in both indigenous villages, which is where maybe some of your more expert listeners will recognize them, their presence and their importance after the conquest as a way to sort of bind the indigenous population to the Catholic Church and to the state. But Catholic lay associations, as logic will tell you, also existed in urban areas. So this book is about urban cofradías. That chapter is based on archival material, several different kinds of records that might give me an insight into gender balances in the cofradías, which I had assumed to be mainly male. It's the men in the cofradías who show up in most archival records. But if you find the kind of stuff that I was looking for, membership lists, records of fee collectors, and probably the most interesting and fun documents that I used to get at the question of how many women were actually in these cofradías before independence were the patentes, they're called. These are certificates that when you joined a cofradía, you were given by the treasurer of the cofradía. They were forms that the treasurer filled in your name, and you then had this record that you had paid the initial fee to join, usually not very much. And then the treasurer also kept a record every time you paid fees on the back of it to be sure that when you died, you were up to date in your payments and you were a member in good standing. So there are all these. And then when you died, you turned them back in to the treasurer. So this is kind of a long way of saying that these documents take up huge amounts of space in archives. And they don't look like much because they're just form letters printed forms. But because they have the name of the person written in by the treasurer, you can usually tell men from women. And almost always the treasurers were very careful to write Doña Maria Josefa Fulano, whatever, or Don, so that you can also tell something about whether these were elite members of the cofradía or not. So I spent a lot of time just paging through those great piles of patentes that I don't think anybody else has used. I was able to develop gender profiles for a fair number. I think as an economist would say, a statistically significant number of cofradías in both Mexico City and in the provinces. And the pattern was very clear that no matter where you were, no matter whether you were in an elite cofradía, which I defined as one with more than 50% dons and doñas, or not, the women constituted not just a significant portion, but a majority of the members of the cofradía. So this is another thing that I think is pretty surprising. Research in Europe on cofradías is beginning to turn up more all-female cofradías or some leadership, female leadership of cofradías, but it still is. It's pretty spotty, and so this is good. This is really good documentation for Mexico of this pattern of female excitement about belonging to the cofradías. I had to speculate in that chapter a little bit about why this was the case, what was the particular appeal for women, especially what I called independent women, women who were joined not as members of a household, but as, you know, a pastry seller. The archival record does not give us great answers as to why, but I tried to understand female and male roles within the cofradías in a way that that respected these decisions made by women to turn over fees that for elite women were not very much, but for non-elite women were, that was a significant financial decision. Therefore, a decision that I felt had to be respected. And I argued that there were limited roles for women. They were not allowed to be officers. They probably didn't vote, although that's sort of an unclear point. But they did have important roles in maintaining, taking care of the object to which the cofradía was dedicated, the image in the church. I think that the colonial background of enthusiastic participation in the cofradías is an important part of the story of trying to understand where the Vela Perpetua and other female-led cofradías after independence comes from. So that was chapter one. In a lot of ways, it's a background chapter, but it's a background chapter that was based on these archival discoveries that that set the stage, I think, particularly well in a way that just a review of the secondary material wouldn't have done.
I think that this chapter is also, like you've just touched on, is a great example of executing what can sometimes be difficult both for modern and then maybe for non-devout historians and readers, which is taking the things these women do seriously and respectfully and imagining that there's a good reason.
I think that's important. I'm perhaps it will be a surprise to learn I'm not a religious person at all. And sometimes the behavior of the women that I met in this archival research was befuddling to me. And I think that part of the fun of writing it, part of what made it meaningful for me to write it was trying to understand and respect where they were coming from.
Well, let's take a look at the second chapter, where in some ways this all sort of falls apart. I mean, it'll continue to fall apart in the reform, but the second chapter studies how these cofradías are affected by the revolution and by independence. So what sort of regional and gender patterns did you notice in how independence did and didn't affect them?
Right. So here I could have used more better secondary material that was very regional in terms of the impacts of independence, financial impacts of independence, because this is the clear explanation for, just to jump ahead a little bit, for the rise of the female-led associations was a failure of the old cofradías, and it was a financial failure. I don't think that it was a result of greater male impiety than female impiety. It wasn't even really a result of men becoming less religious, I think. But it was a result of men being less interested in leading associations because they had become so difficult to lead in light of the destruction of that accompanied the insurgency and the financial difficulties experienced by many cofradías. So, but you asked, and I think this is a really important part of this chapter, about the regional dimensions of this, and building on some of my colleagues who have made a stab at understanding the insurgency regionally, there was an overlap between the places where I saw the cofradías failing. The traditional cofradías failing in every way, and the places where there was presumably the most destruction and the most financial hardship as a result of the insurgency, which is roughly the Bajío and points farther south into Michoacán, into parts of Jalisco, where the fighting endured longer, where it was highly destructive, where parts of Mexico that were linked to the silver mines, which, as everybody knows, were very seriously and negatively affected by the insurgency. So the regional patterns of what happened to the traditional cofradías, I think, map onto the regional patterns in what happened to wealth and to the hacienda, to the silver mines, to manufacturing in the context of the insurgency. So that chapter is spends a good bit of time developing that developing that regional dimension, but it also pays attention to gender and what happens when the traditional cofradía fails. And I argue that it was largely a failure of leadership, as I said before, that it was not a sudden loss of faith on the part of men so much as it was a loss of interest in leading these cofradías that were now likely to cost them a lot of money out of pocket, because the cofradías, the way that they functioned, required pretty large expenditures every year to pay for the celebrations that were associated with the cofradía, but also to pay for, in the case of many cofradías, not all, but many, the death benefits that were paid out by the cofradía to members, which is why the treasurer kept those patentes that we talked about in the context of Chapter 1, so that people could prove they were members in good standing and could collect death benefits, which were substantial. So those older traditional cofradías just needed more money than they were taking in the context of the post-1810 economic depression. So the back to the gendered elements of the collapse of the cofradías, they became basically, in a nutshell, they became even more female dominant than they had been during the colonial period. In the colonial period, it was sort of 59-60% women, and in the 1810s and 1820s and 1830s, the proportion average of female membership rises to around 68-70% women. But the women who remained in these cofradías were hamstrung. They didn't have the leadership roles. They still depended on men for that. They didn't have, they were not the business managers. They didn't have access to the funds. They were, I'm inferring, frustrated. And hence the invention or sort of reinvention of a kind of cofradía that was didn't invest in property, didn't lend money, was not was a much simpler operation financially, and that could be run, and they thought should be run by women, which is the story of Chapter 3, most of which I've already told in the context of the rise of the Vela Perpetua. This is this chapter accounts for that phenomenon, and it also accounts for the increasing presence of women in other kinds of cofradías in 19th century Mexico. But the Vela Perpetua is the one that is sort of strikingly original, strikingly copyable, and spread like wildfire, to use a cliche.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I think that this dynamic of to use your terminology, the failure of male leadership is also going to appear throughout this text, and it will appear especially in the chapter title for Chapter 8, which we'll get to when we do, but I think is fantastically titled.
Great, yeah. So Chapter 4 then changes direction. It changes in the sources that I use, and it begins a process of trying to link Catholic women's political actions, to which I'll return in a minute, to this rise of the cofradías. In other words, I'm positing a link between this explosion of female-led lay associations in the 1840s to a pattern of female petitioning that was first noted in 1849, but then really becomes a phenomenon remarked upon in the liberal press and the Catholic press, and debated at great length in the public sphere in 1856. So these petitions have been noted by historians, by a couple of historians before me. I wasn't the one to discover them, but I think that my attempt to put them in the context of changing relationships between women and the Catholic Church is unique. And the studying the, I do a little bit with analysis of the petitions themselves, trying to understand what it was that women were looking for. I speculate about authorship, because that's been the main theme in writing about these women's petitions, has been, were they really written by women or were they not? Because as you can imagine, the liberal press was convinced that they were written by priests and that women had absolutely nothing to do with them, which is not implausible. And in fact, after a lot of analysis of those petitions and thinking about them, I do think that it was a collaborative effort between priests and women. I don't think that I want to, I certainly don't want to assume that women were incapable of writing these petitions, because I know from my research on women's correspondence in the context of the lay associations that they're entirely capable of doing this, but I'm not sure that they did. But I'm also convinced that they were not oblivious, that they were not simply signing petitions that had been written by priests without even knowing what was the context of them. And I'm absolutely convinced that women were the ones who circulated the petitions in order to get a large number of signatures on them. Sometimes in analyzing petitions or thinking about who wrote them, we tend to ignore the fact that the main importance of a petition is that a lot of people sign it. And the responsibility for collecting signatures was, to me, clearly an area where these new women-led lay associations had a role to play. Now, the role that they played is nowhere provable. There are hints, there are suggestions, but the whole point of the petition is to get a lot more signatures than just the number of people in your association. You go around and you try to get sign up as many people as you can. So these were not petitions written by X pious association. They were written by the ladies of X town, is the way that they were presented. So it's not, as I say, it's not that link that I sought is I'm personally satisfied that there was a connection, but it's and I try to be pretty honest in this chapter and also chapter 6 where I encounter the same problem. I try to be pretty honest with the reader and telling them my reasoning, why I think that these lay associations were involved in the petition movement, possibly in the writing of the petition, but for sure in the circulation and publicizing of the petition. The other interesting thing about chapter 4 is the sort of back and forth between the liberal and the conservative press on the question of whether women should be involved in politics or not. And here's another paradox, or a new form of that same paradox that you identified at the beginning, which is that the Catholic press was more or less forced to defend women becoming involved in politics, and the contortions that they went through in order to approve of this when they, in a lot of ways, didn't really approve of women entering the public sphere were quite interesting. The liberal press is more predictable. The liberal press's reaction was women have no business in politics and they should stay home and take care of the home where they're so important. So that's a kind of reaction to women entering the public sphere that is consistent throughout the Western world. But I think the conservative reaction in the 1850s is kind of a unique and interesting discourse. And it continues, as I've suggested, into the second petition campaign that I deal with in chapter 6. But there's an intermediate chapter, 5. Shall we talk about that one a little bit? So we're going in order, or?
Yes. Let's start with chapter 5, the sort of intermediary period from 1856 to 1875, to be specific. And then also to provide context for maybe some of our listeners that aren't as deeply familiar with Mexican history or historiography. I think this chapter is a really interesting one because it takes place in a time that is supposedly, I think, the nadir of Catholicism or Catholic activism and power in Mexico. When secularization laws are enforced, at least in the 19th century, the nadir. However, you argued that Catholic lay associations are actually blooming and all over the place and have a surprising amount of influence, and that women form a majority of them. So could you tell us a little bit about this time period, and that'll help set us up for chapter 6?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting feature of the historiography, which is just still not very deep on the history of the Catholic Church. If you're mainly looking at the influence of bishops, then it does look like this is a period when the church is back on its heels, when it's having to be super cautious, when it hasn't figured out how to deal with the liberal state, when it's living on the defensive. But if you look at the sort of more ground level, as I did, and the fate of lay associations, they're just being founded and new forms of lay associations being founded willy-nilly during this period. And in some ways, with the perceived threat to the church, it makes sense that lay people would seek something that they can do to help bolster Catholicism and defend the church. And the lay associations have always been meant to be founded by lay people. That's the point. And so they can do this, and they do this. But as the experience of the Vela Perpetua in the 1840s and early 1850s indicated, it's the women who have the most energy for this kind of work. These are not lay associations that have a lot of financial power. They're not lay associations that are weighing in on the issues of the day. They're taking care of churches. They're organizing charity. And there are a lot of new charitable associations that are founded during this period, in addition to the more sort of devotional associations like the Vela Perpetua. And so it's work that is local. It's oriented to the community. It's meant to be an assistant, an aid to the parish priest. It's not super visible at a national level, but if we think of politics as that which bolsters or strengthens one side in a political divide over Catholicism, then what these women were doing, even if it doesn't look like politics in a kind of narrow conventional way, is entirely political. They're strengthening the church at the community level through their foundation of these lay associations and through the work that the lay associations do in schools, in helping with the catechism, in helping the priest in a variety of ways. So the Vela Perpetua continues to spread, and now it spreads out of just that region in the center west where it had really taken off in the 1840s. Now it begins to spread throughout the country. And other associations also develop. Perhaps the two that I spend the most time talking about are both service organizations, the Ladies of Charity, about which my friend and colleague Sylvia Arom has recently published a book, and the Sociedad Católica, which is another Mexican organized service association, so sort of devoted to work in the jails, to home visits, to charitable, more of a charitable profile than a vigil in front of the host, which is what the Vela Perpetua was devoted to. Okay, so in this context in which the, if you look at the top echelons of the church, you see a defensive organization, but if you look at the ground level, you see lots of activity, lots of energy. It's in this context that chapter 6 is situated. Chapter 6 revolves around another petition campaign, this one with hundreds of petitions rather than dozens of petitions, as in 1856. I think in 1856, the number of women's petitions was like 20% of the total petitions. Now, in the 1875 petition campaign, petitions from women are more like 60% of the total number of petitions. And as I say, there are hundreds of them. They come from all over the country. And their object is to protest against the efforts by Sebastián Lerdo de Tejada, who in 1874 decided to elevate the laws of the secularizing laws of the reform to which you referred before into the constitutional into constitutional status. And this brought with it a whole series of regulatory measures that actually concretized some of these secularizing efforts that hadn't really been enforced that much. They'd been decreed or they'd been passed by Congress, but they hadn't really made their way into people's lives, at least, or they had as kind of intermittently, some places enforced those laws more than others. But here was a national effort to make these laws work everywhere in the country. And the other thing that that Lerdo de Tejada did that was bound up in the same effort was to expel, as the conservatives called it, the Sisters of Charity from Mexico, who had founded schools, had worked in hospitals, were more or less beloved. the liberals who had welcomed the Sisters of Charity originally had begun to tire of the sisters, as is, I guess, obvious by the fact that Lerdo de Tejada was ready to expel them. He insisted that he wasn't expelling them, that he was merely requiring them to no longer live in their houses, since no other nuns were, after the laws of the reform, allowed to live in common in their houses. And it's not his fault. He thought if the sisters decided that they didn't want to live this way and that they would leave the country. But it was a huge brouhaha over the Sisters of Charity, which probably energized the women writing these petitions. I mean, there was a lot to protest, which is spelled out in the chapter, but it's not. But the really emotional issue seems to have been the one around whether the Sisters of Charity would be allowed to continue or not. And this chapter six, follows the same method as chapter four. That is, I study the liberal and the conservative press, and I detail the ways that the conservatives, by 1875, 20 years after the original petition campaign, had gone way beyond what they were willing to do in 1856 in terms of defending women's rights to act in the political arena. In fact, arguing that Catholic women were bound, morally obligated to enter the political arena. So they were no longer trying to tippy-toe through the presence of women in the public sphere. They were embracing it. And the liberals' position was the same as it had been in 1856, although even here there was more of a sort of harsher take on how terrible it was that women were leaving the house and participating in politics. In terms of linking the lay associations that had proliferated, as we saw in Chapter 5, to the petition campaign, I encountered the same problems that I had in Chapter 4. There are lots of hints. There's to me satisfying statistics about where the petitions came from and where there were established female-led lay associations. But even more than in 1856, the emphasis was on collecting signatures and not on limiting the impact of the petitions by saying that they came from the Vela Perpetua or the Hijas de Maria or the Sociedad Católica or any of these associations. They didn't want them to be limited. They wanted, you know, everybody, as the liberals accused them of doing, signing up three-year-old children, female children in a household, as adding their names to the petitions. And I know that this happened because I can tell by the way the petitions were organized that you could see the household. And I, in some cases, knew who were members of that household. And I know they weren't three-year-olds, but any child old enough to sign her name was signed up. So this was another big battle over authorship. I think chapter 6 is one of my favorites in the book, just if you, because there's just a lot of really great material from the liberal press and the Catholic press. It's entertaining, I think. In a way that the chapters that are more statistical are important, I think, but maybe not so entertaining as the chapters on women in politics.
This chapter concludes the section on the Reforma and the sort of pre-Porfiriato. And I think it sets up the third part, which is about the Porfiriato, so differently than I think most Catholic histories of the Porfiriato start, because most of them start with things are utterly destroyed. It's a period of rebuilding, which there's still elements of that, obviously. But your seventh chapter, the first in this part on the Porfiriato, is also interestingly titled Excellent Assistance of the Priest, Women and Lay Associations, 1876 to 1911. So in what ways were women and these lay associations assistant to the priests during Porfiriato?
Right. So this is the period when the church does begin, the Porfiriato is a 35-year period. So early in the Porfiriato, the church is indeed still sort of back on its heels a little bit. But already in Rome, the strategy for confronting this secular century had already been well developed, and that was to centralize, make Catholic practices more uniform, to introduce new lay associations where that were approved by Rome. Unsurprisingly, this is a process called Romanization. And here we now begin to see the papacy and the bishops in Mexico beginning to get once again involved in trying at least to control and to found new lay associations. My argument in this chapter is that Romanization, at least in the parts of Mexico that I studied, which were Mexico City, Michoacán, Jalisco, Durango, and Oaxaca, that Romanization did succeed in replacing or supplanting some of the older lay associations, and with ones that had been approved by the Vatican. That does not mean the end of the Vela Perpetua or the Hijas de Maria by any stretch, but those were approved by the Vatican. But there were a number of new associations. I'm not going to go into which ones they were, but they were the Vatican was particularly keen, and the bishops, as linked to the Vatican, were particularly keen to see these lay associations founded in each parish. And they were. I have some kind of astonishing statistics from some of the parishes in Michoacán, which is probably the best archive of all of those places that I named, showing pretty much the disappearance of all cofradías that had existed in 1830 and the presence of all of the sort of top priorities of the Vatican by 1896, 97. So it succeeded, and yet in a very important way, it didn't succeed, and that is in bringing men back into these lay associations. Lay associations were an important tool of the priest to mobilize the community and to moralize the youth and to, as the title of the chapter says, assist the priest. And it became a high priority to get men to rejoin as they had during the colonial period. And in this, the Romanization effort was utterly a failure. The best sort of measures that I have of this come from the Archbishopric of Mexico, where a parish survey from 1896 lists all of the officers of all of the lay associations in all of the reporting parishes. And they didn't all report, but I have a significant majority of the parishes from 1896-97. And the number of women, I was able to, I forgot the statistics right here, I was able to identify 127 associations that were either all female or mixed gender with female leadership, and only 25 associations that were either all male or mixed gender with male leadership. So females, the female membership, and I won't quote more statistics on that, but females continued to just vastly outnumber men in the rank and file membership. And as those statistics I just read show, female leadership was just dominant. So this is a period, the Porfiriato, when the Diaz government, I think historians of this era would agree, frightened or worried about a possible resurgence of Catholic activism. And since Diaz was ostensibly a liberal and upholding this constitution that now had elevated the laws of the reform to constitutional status, it behooved Diaz in his search for political stability to not enforce those laws any more than was absolutely necessary to keep his own liberal factions in content. So there was space for this new round of lay association foundation, lay associations that got involved in every aspect of community life, Catholic life, and therefore, as I in the point that I made before, strengthening Catholicism and Catholic practice kind of at the ground level.
Your eighth chapter picks up on this, and also is just wonderfully titled, "The Men Are Somewhat Preoccupied. Fortunately, the Mexican Woman Carries the Standard of Our Beliefs, Women in Catholic Politics in the Porfiriato." And I think some of our listeners who might know something about the Porfiriato, but maybe aren't experts on it themselves, may be surprised to hear that there was much in the way of Catholic politics at all, because as you described, Porfirio Diaz is very interested in stability and not very interested in political activism. So what did Catholic politics look like? at this time, and what role did women play in them, given their enormous sort of Catholic activist numbers?
Right. So I'm defining Catholic politics as that which strengthens and fortifies the church at the ground level, as I've just said, which is the major goal of Romanization. It's meant to do this ground level work that is not a kind of in your face Catholic politics at the national level, for which during the Porfiriato there was really not a call. Dias himself proclaimed a policy of conciliation with the church, and this kind of hands-off policy allowed the church to re-strengthen itself at the grassroots. So Catholic politics is about trying to reintroduce Catholic doctrine into the schools, which it had been removed from. Catholic politics is also about sort of pushing the envelope when it came to public displays of religiosity, which had been forbidden by the laws of the Reform, and which under this conciliatory regime, national regime, Catholics felt comfortable sort of trying to push back against. One of my favorite episodes from this chapter is the celebration of the coronation of the Virgin of Guadalupe in Mexico City, which was the liberal government was assured all of the celebration would all take place within the church, which is where it was allowed. But of course, people had to traverse the streets to get to the basilica. And as they pointed out, they had to carry their banners with them, and they had their flags and all of their, that which they were going to use to celebrate the Virgin inside the church had to get to the church through the streets. And the people who lived along the route that pilgrims would take to the basilica were forbidden from showing images of the Virgin or images of any sort. But they were not forbidden from decorating their houses. And there was one house whose address I have that lit up the house with electric lights, now in 1894 possible, lit up the house with electric lights that spelled out the word Maria. So it's not an image of Mary, but it is an electric light display celebrating Mary. So this kind of pushing the envelope is part of Catholic politics, I think, during this period in which there's some evidence that lay associations, some direct evidence that lay associations were involved in sort of street protests and that kind of thing, but also were very much involved in creating awesome interiors of churches and really embellishing, returning to the colonial splendor of worship that had been not so possible during the years of economic difficulty, and which now was reinvoked and meant to wow people who came into the churches. And it's very clear that that kind of Catholic practice was the responsibility of women and lay associations as assistants to the priest.
The book concludes with an excellent epilogue connecting this history as a genealogy of the sort of Catholic activism that I think is a little bit more famous in the 20s and 30s and 40s. But let's leave that aside as an enticement for people to pick up the book. Before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now or next?
Yeah. thanks for asking. I've started a project that I'm tentatively calling Gender in the Liberal City. And it may have a chapter that explores a little bit more than I'm able to in this book, the reason why Catholic associations in cities thrived and why liberal associations of women found it so hard to get off the ground until after the revolution. But for the most part, it's new material that is comes at the question of how cities are gendered from a lot of different angles. Some of them that build on research around the reform and how the secularization of space in cities changed the way neighborhoods are experienced. It also, there's going to be a chapter on how on household interiors and how liberal culture, not so much just the laws of the reform, but liberal culture may or may not have penetrated into the way interior spaces in houses are used. There are going to be like 8 different chapters, all of which are a little more standalone than my books so far have been, but all kind of around this idea of what does, how much does liberal culture penetrate Mexican society in the 19th century.
Well, that sounds very interesting as a history of space and how people experience it. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for your time and your excellent book. So thank you so much, Margaret.
Thank you, Ethan.